Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of September. The Presidential Commission on Election Administration launched on May 21st following the President's State of the Union pledge to identify nonpartisan ways to shorten lines at polling places, promote the efficient conduct of elections, and provide better access to the polls for all voters. It's led by co-chairs Robert Bauer, general counsel to the Democratic National Committee, and Benjamin Ginsburg, who served as national counsel to the Romney presidential campaign and is now counsel to the Republican Governors Association. So we're going to be looking at this whole issue, nonpartisan ways to take care of problems that people are encountering when it comes to voting in America. What do you identify as the major problems? We're going to be speaking with two guests during the course of this hour. Jackie Salid is advocate for the rights of independent voters, now 40% of the American electorate. She's president of independentvoting.org, managed Michael Bloomberg's three campaigns for New York City mayor, has provided testimony to the commission, and she is author of Independence Rising, Outsider Movement, Third Parties, and the Struggle for a Postpartisan America. Later in the hour, Myrna Perez will join us, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. For you to be a part of the conversation, all you have to do is call 800-486-8655 is our number, or the email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Jacqueline, thank you very much for joining us. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Tell me about the testimony that you provided to the commission. What is important in this area to you?
Basically, the issue that I've been concerned with, and in every city that the commission has held hearings so far, there are other independents who have testified on these questions. Our issue is to try to urge the commission to look more closely at what is actually going on within the American electorate and to shape its consideration and investigation of the barriers to democratic process in a way that takes that into account. And specifically, as you mentioned in your introduction, we're particularly interested at independentvoting.org in the 40% of Americans who are independents, who are not Democrats or Republicans, and whose participation in the political process is often subdued, suppressed, constrained, and distorted by the existing practices of elections. And so we've been trying to get the commission to shine a light on that.
And how is it being suppressed, Jacqueline?
Oh, it takes a variety of forms, Kathleen. Everything from closed primaries, in which independent voters are not permitted to vote in the first round of elections, to the bipartisan nature of election administration. I mean, even, frankly, the commission itself is a bipartisan commission. The two chairs, as you pointed out in your introduction, are a leading Democrat attorney and a leading Republican, both of them coming out of the Obama and Romney campaigns, respectively. Mm-hmm. So the commission, to some degree, comes to the table reflecting the very bias that we're concerned about. And so partisan redistricting, the way that inspectors are chosen and trained to run the situation at the polls, the composition of the Federal Election Commission to local boards of elections, it's kind of a top-to-bottom bias against independent voters.
And yet, 40%, that's a huge number of Americans who consider themselves independent.
It is huge, and I think it is a very loud statement that a broad segment of the electorate is making that has to do with their dissatisfaction with partisanship, with the way the parties operate, with the way the political system, you know, is so structurally biased in favor of partisanship. Actually, partisanship I think, from the vantage point of the parties, is not a problem. It's actually the solution, which is something that I think has very grave consequences for American democracy. But, yeah, it's a very, very large portion of the electorate. And it's also, at certain points along the way in the last 10 years, has the power of that sleeping giant has been expressed in a variety of ways. And so independents are more and more interested in having full access to the political process, which is the very issue that the president issued his executive order mandating the formation of the commission to deal with. And that's why independents have been coming out and testifying at all these hearings.
So what would be a system that is more fair, primary system, particularly for those who are independent voters?
Well, surely a nonpartisan voter registration system and election systems like the kind that has been adopted by the voters in California and Washington, which is sometimes referred to as a top two nonpartisan primary system, where basically instead of having party primaries, where independents are often barred from voting, you have a public primary, where all candidates compete against one another and all voters get to cast ballots regardless of their affiliation. And then the top two finishers go on to a general election, and in the course of that process, new coalitions and new alliances form, and then all the voters have the opportunity to come out and choose between those top two candidates. That's a system that, in effect, Kathleen, privileges voters over parties. Parties have their role. They're a constitutionally protected, you know, a political association in America, and they advance certain ideas and aggregate people around shared agendas. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that when the power of the parties becomes, in a sense, quasi-governmental, and the playing field is tilted in favor of the parties in ways that are, you know, very destructive, I think, to democracy.
So, Jacqueline, was that a hard sell in California and Washington, and how was it accomplished?
Oh, that's such a great question. Was it a hard sell? Well, it wasn't a hard sell to the voters because they voted it up. They liked it. It was a very hard sell to the parties in California. All of the parties, the major parties and the minor parties, very virulently opposed it, and most politicians opposed it as well, with a couple of exceptions. Actually, Governor Schwarzenegger, who was governor at the time that the initiative passed, supported it, as did the lieutenant governor, Abel Maldonado, who actually was the person who was instrumental in getting it before the voters. But what tends to happen, Kathleen, and this won't surprise you, is that, you know, the power stakeholders tend to oppose any kind of political reform that creates uncertainty for them. And this kind of open primary, nonpartisan primary system creates a huge amount of uncertainty, and they're afraid of that. But, you know, the voters actually are kind of, I think, wise about that, because their view is, well, actually, we're not supposed to have certainty before the election is held. The election is supposed to be when certainty is created by virtue of what the voters do. So it really has produced a huge clash between establishment partisan forces and grassroots outsider pro-reform forces.
Do you see this spreading at all? Are other states taking this up?
Definitely. I think it is. We were part of a coalition in Arizona that put the issue on the ballot there and put it before the voters. It lost. There was huge opposition. And by the way, some interesting coalitions were formed against it to defeat it. The League of Women Voters in Arizona joined forces with the political circle around Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is well known in this country as a far right, ultra conservative. So the Arpaio forces and the League of Women Voters joined forces against this reform and were instrumental in its defeat. There's talk about, but you know, it will come back around. We tried to introduce this and get it passed in New York City. You mentioned my involvement in the Bloomberg campaigns. I was very involved in in creating a coalition with the mayor to try to bring nonpartisan elections to New York City. Over the last decade, we haven't succeeded in doing that. In New York, the Democratic Party machine, which is the major power stakeholder, has been hugely opposed to it. There's talk in Colorado of putting an initiative on the ballot that would put that before the voters. But in answer to your question, yes, I think that there's a slow build on this issue because I think the frustration with partisanship and with a system that reinforces it is growing it, and I don't think that that frustration will be containable forever.
Mm-hmm. Let's center on the issue of partisan redistricting, which seems to be problematic in so many states now. The census comes around, and if you're in power in all forms of government in a state, you've really set elections for some time to come. And I think that there is concern about that. Is there a better way to do this, and are you championing another kind of redistricting?
Yeah, I mean, basically what you really have to do is you have to take control of the drawing of district lines out of the hands of the legislature, because the legislature is, you know, by its very nature, a partisan body in which, you know, partisan allegiance and partisan affiliation is dramatically reinforced by the caucus system and, you know, the majority-minority split and all of that. In California, the voters chose, by the way, in addition to creating a nonpartisan top two system, they also created a nonpartisan redistricting system in which there is a body that draws lines that includes independents, gets outside of the entire control of legislative prerogative. So, yeah, there are models for this, and frankly, it would be fairly easy to do. It's just that, you know, the partisan stakeholders have such a grip on, you know, control of these kinds of processes in a way that it's almost taken for granted. It's almost unimaginable, you know, to say, well, could we find a way to draw district lines that isn't done in a partisan manner? Well, the answer is yes, of course we could.
Mm-hmm.
Of course we could. We just have to build a movement and empower a movement, and that can change the mindset and the actual engineering around these kinds of things. It's really not that difficult to do. It's just that, you know, there's very powerful forces that oppose it.
Let's talk about another thing in New York has been mentioned when we look at voting machines. You've just been through a primary in New York City. I have read, and some people have talked to the commission about how the machines are just not working very well and they break down, and maybe it's not just peculiar to New York City, but it is a problem. Would you say in New York?
It's surely been a problem. Actually, in New York, we finally moved away from the voting machines to a new form of technology. And then, given that the New York mayoral primary was expected to go to a runoff, the Board of Elections said that they couldn't handle a runoff on the new machines, and so they had to revert to the old system and bring these, you know, old dinosaur machines out of the store and bring them out. I mean, look, technology, yeah, the commission heard a lot of testimony on technology, and that's all good. I mean, I think on that score, I think they've actually done a very good job. But I do have problems, frankly, and I'm not the only one. Independentvoting.org is not the only democracy organization that is concerned about the way the commission has been framing the hearings and the discussion and the dialogue. You know, folks from Common Cause, from the League of Women Voters, from the ACLU, you know, from other groups based in the states where they've held the hearings, and surely we have, expressed concern about, if you will, the disconnect between the size of the problem that we face to make our democracy vital and efficient on the one hand, and the narrowness and the smallness of how the commission is responding to it. I wrote in a piece that was published in the Daily Beast that it's a little bit like opening an umbrella in the middle of a hurricane. It is so it is so inconsequential relative to the real issues that our democracy faces, that it's somewhat disheartening, which is why I think it's very important to keep the pressure on the commission and, frankly, to keep the pressure on the president. I mean, the president formed the commission because there was a huge amount of uproar.
Yes.
About voter suppression, about long lines, about photo ID, about, you know, all of these issues. But then it all gets kind of translated into a kind of bureaucratic and administrative approach to issues. These aren't administrative and bureaucratic issues. These are fundamental issues that are at the core of what America is. And so many Americans are upset about and concerned about the state of our democracy. The last thing we want to do is turn this into a discussion about, you know, which voting machine, you know, makes it easier for the board to count the votes. I mean, the voting machine that's the easiest to count is the one that we should get, but that's not the problem. The problem is, for example, 40% of the country are excluded from full participation in the political process. That's a serious problem.
Jacqueline Salid, advocate for the rights of independent voters, is with us, and we are talking, she's president of independentvoting.org, managed Michael Bloomberg's three campaigns for New York City mayor. Let's zero in during the time that we have with her on this system, which is intriguing, the top two system. So it opens primaries to everybody, and you vote for the top two candidates. It's not a closed primary. 40% of the American public identifying themselves as independent voters. Would this make this much more open to everybody, whatever you consider yourself, your political affiliation? Is that a way for everybody to go? And we could also look at the issue of redistricting, which from listening to her seemed to be the top two issues for her. We're talking about voting in this country. The Presidential Commission on Election Administration was launched a few months ago and charged with identifying nonpartisan ways to make voting better in this country. What do you think? Would you like that top two system? Do you think that we need to look at a different model for redistricting? Are those crucial issues, particularly to those of you who may identify yourselves as independent voters? Here's our phone number. We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Can video games help develop empathy, focus, and self-control in children? At 4 o'clock today on Central Time, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert will look into that by examining some new mindfulness apps with the Center for the Investigation of Healthy Minds. And our program, Hour 2, I love doing presidential biographies. This one is on Woodrow Wilson, just released, and pretty highly acclaimed book by Scott Berg. We'll look at our 28th president, Woodrow Wilson. Two phone calls now for Jacqueline, and let's start with John in Appleton. Hello, John.
Greetings.
Hi.
That's a great show, Kathleen, and WPR. Since we're changing history, I wanted to know what the guests thought about two things. One's real specific. The Iowa county redistricting process, did you look at that, or how could that fit within the top two, layout? And secondly, bigger question is, what do you think it takes to make real societal change? Does it take just a coalition of people in each state with the same idea, or what does it take?
That's a good question. Jacqueline?
Yeah. John, thanks for those questions. Briefly on the Iowa redistricting process, it's a good one. And actually, Iowa is held up as the state in the country that has the most nonpartisan, most objective system for drawing district lines. And it's been very, very successful and successfully applied. And I think it's probably a basic model that every state should adopt. With respect to the issue that you're raising about, you know, how you affect change, it's such an important question. The way that I think about this is that I think coalitions are very, very important, and I think I'm a big fan of an activist in national coalitions and state-based coalitions around democracy issues of all kinds, all good. But I think maybe, for me at least, a core point or a core principle is that I think it's the outsiders that are the engine for the kind of culture change that we're looking for in the political process, largely because the insiders are stakeholders in the status quo. I've been really interested to see, for example, when independents step forward and have the capacity to move an agenda for opening up the political process, like with, you know, the top two open primaries in California, that so many rank-and-file Democrats and Republicans join in and support that, basically because they agree that the more open and participatory the process is, the better it is for everyone, that it's really just the elected officials and the parties and often the editorial boards that are locked down into maintaining, you know, the current political arrangement. So I really see it as an outsider coalition that focuses very much on the issues of political process. And this is important. Let me just say one other thing here. This is important because process issues actually allow you to bring people together across ideological lines. Social issues, economic issues can tend to be broken down along ideological fault lines. But process issues actually have the capacity to bring people together from right to left. And that is so important now because the political system really is so disunifying and really thrives on divisions and divisiveness. So the extent to which we can create an up-from-the-bottom outsider movement that's focused on process and allows for breaking out of the ideological divide, I think the better off we are.
Do you have any idea, Jacqueline, how many states redistrict in a way that's similar to Iowa's? Is this just an aberration?
It's an aberration.
Is it?
Yes. Uh-huh. The answer is almost none.
Really?
Yeah. I think California got a little bit closer to it, you know, with the citizen-enacted new form, which at least empowered independents as part of the group that is, you know, looking at and drawing district lines. But, yeah, almost none. Almost none. Mm.
John, thanks so much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Fred in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. A great show, as always. And I like your guest, Kathleen, or Jacqueline. I just think it's kind of ironic that she talks about outsiders and process, because she worked very closely with Mayor Bloomberg of New York. And my comment is this: who would vote? What about voter IDs? Who would vote? That is the question. The redistricting thing is a sideshow. The big issue is who can vote, and that is process, and that is quite strictly outsiders versus insiders. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate your comments, Fred. My answer to the question of who should vote is everyone. I think it's fairly simple. And I think what we have now is a system that sorts voters out, that precludes voters from participating, that breaks people into categories, that closes certain aspects of the process along the way. Yeah, and I'm very proud of the work that I did with Mike Bloomberg. I ran his campaigns on the Independence Party line in New York, and we have Fusion in New York, which allows voters to choose the line they vote on, and his independent votes were his margin of victory. The Independence Party also became a lightning rod for a new kind of progressive coalition, which is focused on process issues and which breaks down ideological categories and which united, for example, African-American voters and independent voters in a new coalition. The basis of that coalition with Mike was all around process issues. He was a big supporter of nonpartisan elections. And as he and I talked about on many, many occasions, what we have in New York City, just to give one example, is we have 1 million voters, 24% of whom are Latino, 20% of whom are African American, 11% of whom are Asian American, who are prevented from voting in first round voting, in which 99% of the elections in New York City are decided. This is a vast form of voter suppression and disenfranchisement, and nonpartisan elections would cure that problem. And he and I work closely together on that issue, and I am totally proud of that, and I hope we continue to do that even after he leaves the mayoralty.
And they were prevented from voting for what reason, Jacqueline?
Because we have closed primaries, because they're not Democrats, okay, or Republicans.
Thank you, Fred, so much for your call. And we'll talk more about voter ID with our next guest. Don't want you to think that we have neglected that issue. Jane in River West. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to speak. And I love your show.
Thanks.
And I love your guests. And everything you have to say resonates extremely strongly with me. What I want to add to the discussion is I was born a Democrat in the womb and became a civil rights activist in my young adulthood, living much of my adulthood in mixed communities or Latino communities, working and in both in my work to help the marginalized as well as, you know, friendships and community building and all of that. And what I want to share is that I think there, and you, I'm sure, recognize this, that this goes beyond independent voters to the concern that many Democratic citizens and possibly Republican citizens as well have about the fact that historically we have, over the centuries, generally progressed in opening up the voting voting rights and the voice of the people in the actual, not only in voting, but also in the actual process of governing. And we have regressed. We have regressed in our, and people are trying, or our politicians are trying to further that regression. Bill Moyers talks a lot about this, and it's extremely disturbing.
All right, let's get a response to that, centering, I guess, on minorities not having full access to voting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what Jane is saying is something that many people feel. I think she's characterizing the situation accurately. Things did progress. Actually, an interesting feature, this goes to the question that John asked about how you create movements for change. You know, throughout the history of this country, it's been independent movements that generated social change from the abolitionist movement to the women's suffrage movement to the labor movement and all of that, because the major parties were able to incorporate these demands and these agendas into their own. What's interesting and different, I think, about the situation today and why this 40% figure is so important is that now the issue is not just a social agenda. The issue is the problem of the parties themselves. And consequently, if you're looking to bring this concern into the mainstream and empower this agenda and this huge constituency, this sleeping giant, it's very hard to go to the parties to ask them to do it, since in effect what you're asking them to do is to disempower themselves. And that's why this independent movement is growing, and that's why it's going to be, in my opinion, the engine and the impetus for change. But and I would say also, in some respects, this is exactly what we're trying to bring to the attention of the commission. And I would invite Jane and other of your listeners to go to our website and sign on to a letter that we have to the commission. Over 1,000 independents from 50 states have signed on to this letter, and it's at www.independentvoting.org, Jane and others. And we'd love to have you visit the website and sign on to this letter so that we can really bring this issue center stage and into the political mainstream.
Jacqueline, thank you ever so much for being with us. I hope you'll be with us again.
Thanks so much for having me, Kathleen.
Jacqueline Salit, she is president of independentvoting.org. You can get more information concerning all that she was talking about if you go to that site. She's an advocate for the rights of independent voters. If you're just tuning in, there was a Presidential Commission on Election Administration started May 21st, the president in the State of the Union addressed the issue of nonpartisan ways to shorten lines at polling places, promote the efficient conduct of elections, and also provide better access to the polls for all voters. The commission has been meeting. They just met last week, and they will soon be giving a final report to the president. We're talking with people who are interested in the process of voting and who have testified before this commission. There has been some criticism of the commission as to whether or not they're too bureaucratic, a criticism you heard from Jacqueline. Also interesting ideas from her concerning top two, voting for the top two candidates and the way we redistrict. Our guest this next part of the show will also talk about voter ID and some other concerns. She is Myrna Perez, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law, and she works on redistricting, voter registration lists, maintenance, and also access to the ballot box. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Myrna at 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Myrna. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with you on the issue of voter ID and lack of access to polling restrictions that are being faced. Is this a crucial issue right now, and are you hopeful that the commission will address this in a substantial way?
I think you've asked two different questions. The first is whether or not this is a crucial issue. We certainly do have a concern in our country about two competing issues that don't have to be competing but are often framed as such. One is access to the polls, and the other is voter security. And throughout these discussions, there are certain elements in this country that recommend, as a way of dealing with the security issue, imposing a strict photo identification requirement that a non-trivial portion of eligible Americans may not have. We can expect that up to about 11% of United States citizens do not have the kind of government-issued photo identification that our strictest laws have. But having said that, that was not one of the main issues that the executive order issued to the Presidential Commission on Election Administration to cover. Instead, they're dealing with issues like number, location, and management and operation of the polling places, poll workers, how you vote if you're a uniformed or an overseas voter, and those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. And so it's not going nearly far enough?
I think that the problem of long lines and the problems of election administration is big and varied, and think that there's plenty on its plate now, but certainly that should not and will not be the ends of the conversation. I think we need to make the most of what this commission is, which is a term-limited commission to study some narrow issues, and hopefully the public will participate in the public process, and we will get good recommendations from this commission, and Congress will feel comfortable acting on those, and the states will step in when Congress doesn't.
So if you were going to go and talk in front of the commission and your big issue was voter ID and how people don't have voter IDs and how, as some may believe, that it's another form of discrimination and serious discrimination, they wouldn't listen to you?
No, and my organization, the Brennan Center for Justice, did speak before the commission. We've submitted testimony. We spoke on September 4th, and we raised as our biggest priority the issue of voter registration modernization. There are up to 50 million eligible Americans that cannot vote on Election Day because they are not registered to vote, and we know that at any given point in time, on any major election day, that up to 3 million eligible citizens couldn't vote because of a problem related to registration. And so our recommendations are focusing on trying to leverage existing technology to make sure that every eligible American is able to get registered, along with some other concerns, and that is squarely and firmly within the scope of the the executive order.
Mm-hmm. And tell me how registration could become easier for those 3 million voters.
So there are a number of things that can be done. One of the things that we very much like to encourage states to do, and it is gaining steam in the states, is to utilize technology in common sense ways, in ways that happen in every element of our life. Currently, our voter registration system depends entirely too much on paper. In many parts of the country, if you go to a DMV or if you go to a social service agency, in order to be able to register to vote, you have to fill out a piece of paper that then has to get bundled in a stack of mail, that then has to get mailed over to an election official, that then has to get typed in, and then has to get spit out onto some voter registration rolls. These computers should be able to talk to each other. The information should be transmitted electronically. It is a cheaper way to deal with things because you don't have to print out all that paper. You don't have to pay people to do that data entry. It cleans up the rolls. There are far fewer typos and far fewer mistakes in the rolls when people don't have to be trying to figure out other people's chicken scratching or when they can't figure out other people's writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes the rolls more accurate because you don't have those kinds of errors. So we find that it gets bipartisan support because it both accomplishes a goal of access and integrity mm-hmm. and security, and it doesn't cut people out of the process. In fact, it brings more people in by making sure that those institutions where people congregate at and people already do business with are involved actively in the voter registration process.
Mm. Let's talk about those long lines, definitely within the purview of the commission, mm-hmm. and we saw pictures of incredibly long lines. We were told mm-hmm. people were waiting 7 to 8 hours in the last presidential election, which is absolutely ridiculous. There have been some states who have been cutting down on early voting. What are your thoughts on early voting? What has the commission heard about expanding early voting as a possible solution to reducing some of that long waiting in line?
The commission has certainly heard a lot about early in-person voting. Some of the benefits that folks have seen from that is that it in addition to alleviating long lines, it improves poll worker performance. It allows for early identification and correction of voting errors. It provides increased voter satisfaction, and it reduces stress on the voting systems. One of the recommendations that has been suggested is that there be certain standards by which states adopt for early in-person voting. So our research suggests that it should be a full 2 weeks before Election Day. That's the way you get a number of the benefits, especially if you include weekends. The last weekend before the Election Day is a very high turnout date in those states that have early in-person voting. There should be a minimum number of daily hours that are set each day, and the states should be consistent about those hours, and they should provide for extended hours beyond normal business hours. Many of the people trying to take advantage of early in-person voting options are because they have less flexible work schedules, and so we do need to have longer hours on those election days. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just wondering, Myrna, if there's bipartisan agreement on that.
There is in a lot of respects. I mean, we have seen attacks and attempts to cut back early voting. But the states that have early in-person voting, you know, their election administrators love it. And then obviously early in-person voting has become embroiled in many of the partisan fights that we've seen in the states. One of the steps that happened in North Carolina in their omnibus bill that is getting a lot of criticism for being one of the most restrictive, if not the most restrictive and regressive voting law in the country, is that it reduces the number of early in-person voting days.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, there are folks who are not affiliated with any parties, and there are election officials that are affiliated with both sides of the aisle that really stand by early in-person voting, that believe that it increases the management of polling place resources and that it's a very good way to provide good customer service to voters.
We're going to welcome phone calls from Myrna. We'll take them in a moment. Myrna Perez is Deputy Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. We're talking about the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. They're going to present their report to the president pretty soon now. And they've been hearing from places like the Brennan Center on a number of issues. They have a mission that looks specifically at this: nonpartisan ways to shorten lines at polling places, promote the efficient conduct of elections, and provide better access to the polls for all voters. Our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Neil from Slinger is our next caller. Hello.
Hello. I fail to understand all the flap over voting, the hodgepodge of voting and redistricting, et cetera, throughout the nation. We're obviously not a unified nation. I strongly feel, as the current speaker said now, about using technology, and I feel that all citizens' votes should weigh the same, and the tally be made, and that's it, and that the government requests that the citizens study as carefully as they can, given all the technology, and then make their decision whom to vote for. And let's not exclude citizens. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Myrna?
I agree. I think most Americans, almost all Americans, want our democracy to be free, fair, and accessible, and are very interested in using common sense ways to make sure that our voting systems are efficient and function the way that they should.
Fred in Minong. Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering about, and I've always been confused about the fact that we've had happen in recent presidential elections where a president or a candidate running for the presidency receives more popular vote, and yet because of the electoral voting system, loses the election. If it's supposed to be a government of the people speak with the popular vote, and yet the end result is not in response to their voting. How can that be justified?
Myrna, are you upset about that as well? I mean, should we change the whole system?
Well, there are a number of folks working on that. There is a proposal called the National Popular Vote. You can read more about it in an organization at a website called www.fairvote.org. And the idea is to have states enter into compacts with each other such that they will confer their electoral college votes in accordance with the popular vote. It's certainly something that's getting a lot of attention, both scholarly and popularly, and it's something that a lot of folks are looking at as a big systemic reform. Mm.
But people have been looking. I remember doing debate topics on that in high school. We've been talking about it forever, haven't we?
Yeah, it's a long topic. I mean, the Electoral College is, you know, part of our institutional structure, and there are certainly a number of reasons that folks believe that it is not the most representative way to elect our leaders. And for that reason, I think there's a strong appetite for suggestions like the National Popular Vote Compact that continue to have a lot of staying power.
Mm-hmm. So this commission is almost done with its work. You've had all of this testimony before the commission. It will present a final report to the president, and then something will be done on what issues or what?
Well, I think no one knows for sure. The hope that the Brennan Center has is that there will be common sense and evidence-based solutions to many of the election administration problems of our day, and because of its format about being done in a bipartisan manner, that Congress will take whatever action that it can, and the states will be inspired to step in the breach.
Our previous guest talked quite a bit about a couple issues that were very interesting. One is redistricting. Do you have thoughts and a policy paper on redistricting? Do you think that it puts way too much power in the hands of political parties?
We certainly do take a position on redistricting. We think that there are a bunch of different models for redistricting. There's no one-size-fits-all approach. We do live in a country where states have a lot of latitude to enact policies that are good for their states. But having said that, we do think that there are some guiding principles that all state redistricting processes should include. That includes a great deal of public notice and access so that the voters can participate, an explanation of how the decision making is done and who the winners and the losers will be, transparency and openness in the redistricting process, lots of access points for the public to be able to present the ways that they believe that their communities should be kept together, and prohibitions that allow politicians for treating the redistricting process as a 10-year job security plan.
Hmm. Jeffrey in Hazel Green sends an email. His concern is with convicted felons. Shouldn't all free people be allowed the right to vote? And what, if anything, would the commission do about this?
There is a severe deficit in our democracy today, in that we have up to 5 million Americans who are unable to vote because of a criminal conviction, and up to 4 million of those are living and working in our communities. Some parts of our country make it such that you never lose the right to vote. You're able to vote even when you're in prison, like Maine and Vermont. And then there are other states, like Kentucky and Florida, that when you have committed a criminal act and receive a felony conviction, you lose your right to vote for life, mm-hmm. unless the governor takes it upon himself or herself to expressly pardon you. And it is my view, it is the Brennan Center's view, that having Americans who are living and working in the community and trying to reintegrate into society, not being able to vote is counter to our democratic ideals and also counterproductive to the idea of a successful reentry. Many police officers, many law enforcement personnel are strongly of the view that if we want people to be integrated and we want people to be productive members of society, they need to be given a stake in our society, they need to be invested in our society, and they need to be engaging in pro-social behavior, and voting is a very pro-social act. So it is certainly a big problem, and we work very hard on the state and the federal level to try and get states to ease restrictions on the right to vote with persons with criminal convictions.
And Myrna, finally, I want to get into this whole area of whether or not voting has become so highly partisan. It does seem as though certain states, if you're under one party's control, is making certain kind of laws, and other states with other kinds of control or other kinds of laws or voting systems. Is it partisan, and is it as highly partisan as you've ever seen?
I do think it is true that in the last few years, we saw a significant, profound, and historic attempt to roll back voting rights in this country. In the years right up before the presidential election, we saw states from coast to coast introduce a wave of restrictive legislation. But the upside to that is the voters fought back. Voters fought back, the courts fought back, Department of Justice fought back, advocacy organizations like the Brennan Center, others fought back. And when we headed into the election in 2012, we were facing far fewer restrictions than what we expected to. And right now, with the Supreme Court decision in the Shelby County case, which eliminated the most effective tool this country has had in combating racial discrimination in voting, we need to be vigilant, because there is a very real, palpable, and impending concern that states that have a bad history of racial discrimination in voting will continue to act in a bad way and will continue to deprive people of the opportunity to a free and fair vote. And it's really important that we all remember that the right to vote is fundamental and that we be very vigilant about protecting our rights.
Myrna, thank you ever so much for being with us. Myrna Perez, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Her particular interests, redistricting, voter registration list maintenance, and access to the ballot box. The commission will have a final report in just a couple months. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. Thanks for your calls and emails and Facebook messages and everything. We have news coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio, and we'll return and talk about Woodrow Wilson.